Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and Dan Novak. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, birds of prey, also known as raptors, are species of birds that feed almost entirely on meat that they hunt. A new report shows that these birds are dropping in number worldwide. Researchers from the International Union for the Conservation of Nature and BirdLife International studied 557 raptor species. They found that 167 of the bird species are considered near-threatened, vulnerable or endangered, or critically endangered. Their study also reported that 18 species are critically endangered, including the Philippine eagle, the hooded vulture, and the Anabom scops owl. Gerardo Ceballos is a bird scientist at the National Autonomous University of Mexico. He was one of the writers of the study, which appeared earlier this month in the publication Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. He noted that other species are in danger of becoming locally extinct in some areas of the world. That means they may no longer play important parts as top hunters in those environments. The golden eagle is the national bird of Mexico, but we have very few golden eagles left in Mexico, he said. A 2016 study estimated only about 200 remain in the country. Harpy eagles were once widespread throughout southern Mexico and Central and South America. But tree cutting and burning has greatly decreased their range. The study found that 54% of threatened birds of prey that are active mostly during the day, including most hawks, eagles, and vultures, were falling in population. The same was true for 47% of threatened raptors active mostly at night, such as owls. Evan Buckley is a researcher at the Smithsonian Migratory Bird Center and a scientist at nonprofit Hawk Watch International. He was not involved in the study. He said the biggest threats to birds of prey are habitat loss, climate change, and poisonous substances. The insect-killing substance DDT thinned eggshells and destroyed bald eagle populations in North America, leading to its ban in the U.S. in 1972. But Buckley said other threats remain, including rodent-killing substances and the lead in hunters' ammunition. Many raptors feed on rodents and dead animals. Widespread use of a drug used in farm animals led to the fast decline of vultures in South Asia. The birds died after eating animal remains, which decreased the population of some species by 95% in recent decades. In East Asia, many raptor species reproduce in northern China, Mongolia, or Russia. They then travel down the eastern coast of China to spend summers in Southeast Asia or India. Certain areas of the coast will see 30 to 40 species during peak migration, said Yang Liu. He is an ecologist at Sun Yat-sen University in Guangzhou and was not involved in the study. He said that areas with thousands of birds passing through them are important to protect. Stuart Butchart is chief scientist at BirdLife International in Britain. He said that most of the 4,200 areas identified by conservation groups as critical for raptor species worldwide are unprotected or only partly covered by protected areas. A 2018 study in the publication Biological Conservation found that 52% of all raptor species worldwide are decreasing in population.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel is preparing to step down after leading the country for 16 years. As she leaves office, she is seen as a leader with strong diplomatic skills who had to deal with a series of major crises in Europe. In Germany, Merkel did carry out some major government programs. These included ending the country's requirement of national military service and setting Germany on a path away from nuclear and coal power production. She also enabled the legalization of same-sex marriage and took the lead on setting a national minimum wage and a program to provide assistance to fathers to take care of young children. But one of her senior allies recently described what many see as her main service, an anchor of stability in stormy times. The ally told Merkel, "You protected our country well." Bavarian Governor Markus Söder similarly explained Merkel's leadership. He said of the crises facing Germany, "They came overnight and you had to govern well." Merkel passed her first test in 2008, promising at the height of the world financial crisis that Germans' savings were safe. Over the following years, she helped lead efforts to save the euro from the debt crisis that hurt several European Union members. She agreed to government assistance plans, but also said painful spending cuts were needed. In 2015, Merkel welcomed migrants as masses of people fleeing conflicts in Syria and elsewhere traveled across the Balkans. She permitted in hundreds of thousands and promised that we will manage the flow. The program later faced resistance both at home and among European partners. Working with other international leaders, Merkel sought to seek compromises and explore a multilateral path to the world's problems. This continued through years of political developments. These included changes in the relationship between the U.S. and its European allies under President Donald Trump and Britain's decision to leave the European Union. Merkel led Germany's COVID-19 response that saw the country do better than some of its neighbors. The health emergency was just one example of a crisis Merkel had to manage. Ralph Bollmann is a reporter who also wrote a book about Merkel's life and time. I think Miss Merkel's most important legacy is simply that, in such a time of worldwide crises, she provided for stability, he told the Associated Press. I'm Brian Lynn.
Nine out of ten American adults have unhealthy metabolisms, mostly because of the food they eat. Experts say it might be time for the government to regulate what Americans put in their mouths. Dariush Mozafarian is a heart doctor at Tufts University in Massachusetts. He said the food industry is the only area of the economy where we have the majority of products being knowingly dangerous, and we leave it up to the public to decide what to have. If there is a product that hurts people, we get rid of it, Mozafarian said. To look at someone's metabolic health, doctors measure things like blood sugar, cholesterol, and blood pressure. People who are in poor metabolic health are at increased risk of getting diabetes, heart disease, and other serious health problems. When you have 9 out of 10 adults being metabolically unhealthy, largely due to diet-related illnesses, you know we have a broken system, Mozafarian said. A big part of the problem is that Americans eat a lot of junk food. Junk foods are processed foods like sweets or potato chips that provide little nutritional value and are high in fat, salt, and sugar. A study by the National Institutes of Health found that junk foods account for 1 out of every 7 calories in adults and 1 out of every 5 calories in children. Junk foods are hard to resist because they contain things the body wants and needs. Sweet, salty, and fatty foods are things that are very necessary to live. They're energy providing, said Linda Bartoshek. She is a professor of food science at the University of Florida. The problem, she said, is that the body has a hard time knowing when to stop wanting them. We take in too much salt, too much sugar, too much fat, and it produces all kinds of illnesses, Bartoshek said. Mozafarian is among health experts who are calling for more policies to help Americans eat healthier foods. He would like to see the federal government improve nutrition in existing food programs, like the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, and Meals on Wheels. SNAP provides financial aid to poor families to buy food, and Meals on Wheels delivers meals to older Americans. Mozafarian also thinks food nutrition should be included in the healthcare system. Even though Americans are getting less healthy, the United States spent $3.8 trillion on healthcare in 2019. Doctors, for example, could write prescriptions for healthy foods that are partially or fully paid for, Mozafarian said. He also thinks there could be more nutritional education for healthcare workers and students in medical school. And while Mozafarian believes nutritional education would be effective, changing Americans' diet is most important, he said. we're going to need to fix the food, right? So that parents and kids who are busy and out wanting to enjoy their lives can get nutritious, affordable food, he said. I'm Dan Novak.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. We have been talking about the War of 1812 between the United States and Britain. In the summer of 1814, the two countries opened peace talks at Ghent in Belgium. But Britain was in no hurry to agree on a peace treaty. This week, we tell the story of how the war ended. British forces were planning several campaigns in the United States in the autumn and winter of 1814. Successful military campaigns could force the United States to accept the kind of treaty Britain wanted. British representatives to the talks demanded that the United States give control of its Northwest Territory to the Indians. They also asked that the United States give part of the state of Maine to Canada and make other changes in the border. The Americans made equally tough demands. The United States wanted payment for damages suffered during the war. It also wanted the British to stop seizing American sailors for the British Navy. And the United States wanted all of Canada. The British representatives said they could not even discuss the question of stopping impressment by Americans into the British Navy. And the Americans would surrender none of their territory. Most of America's representatives had little hope the talks would succeed. But then Britain received word that its military campaigns had failed at Baltimore and Plattsburgh. After that, the British representatives became easier to negotiate with. They dropped their demands for American territory. The Americans then dropped their demands for Canadian territory. The issues that had led to the war no longer existed. Britain's war with France had caused the British and French to interfere with neutral American trade. And Britain had needed men for its navy. Now the war with France was over. No longer was there any reason to interfere with the trade of any nation. And no longer was there any need to seize Americans for service in the British Navy. On December 24th, the day before Christmas in 1814, the United States and Britain signed a simple treaty. Each side agreed to stop fighting. They also agreed to settle all their differences at future negotiations. The war had ended, but one more battle was to be fought before news of the peace treaty reached the United States. During the autumn of 1814, British soldiers at Jamaica began preparing for an attack against New Orleans, a city at the mouth of the Mississippi River. Late in November, this force of about 7,500 men sailed from Jamaica to New Orleans. The British soldiers were commanded by General Edward Pakenham. The general did not take his men directly to the mouth of the Mississippi River. Instead, they sailed across a lake east of the city. Early during the afternoon of December 23rd, General Andrew Jackson, the commander of American forces at New Orleans, learned that the British force was near. General Jackson was a good soldier and a great leader. He fought in the Revolutionary War, then studied law. He moved west to Nashville, Tennessee. The general also served in both houses of the United States Congress. When war broke out in 1812, he was elected general of a group of volunteer soldiers from Tennessee. Jackson was a rough man. His soldiers feared and respected him. They called him Old Hickory because he seemed as tough as hickory wood. Jackson was given responsibility for defending the coast along the Gulf of Mexico. Earlier in the year, he had attacked Pensacola in Florida and forced out several hundred British Marines. Jackson believed the British would attack Mobile before attacking New Orleans. He left part of his forces at Mobile and took the others to the mouth of the Mississippi. Jackson was a sick man when he got to New Orleans, and what he found made him feel no better. Little had been done to prepare for the expected British attack. Jackson declared martial law and began building the city's defenses. Most of the work on the defenses had been completed when Jackson got word that the British were only a few kilometers from New Orleans. "Gentlemen," Jackson told his officers, "the British are below. We must fight them tonight." The British soldiers rested. They believed it would be easy to capture the city the next day. But Jackson rushed up guns and men and attacked the British by surprise just after dark. Then the Americans retreated to a place about 8 kilometers south of the city. Jackson had chosen this place carefully. On the right was the Mississippi River. On the left was the mud and water of a swamp that could not easily be crossed. In front of the American soldiers was an open field. For 2 weeks, the British soldiers waited. They tested the American defenses at several places, but found no weaknesses. Every day, Jackson had his men improve their positions. At night, small groups of Jackson's soldiers would slip across the field and silently attack British soldiers guarding the other side. Finally, on January 8th, the British attacked. They expected the Americans to flee in the face of their strong attack, but the Americans stood firm. Jackson's artillery fired into the enemy. When the British got as close as 150 meters, the Americans began to fire their rifles. The rain of bullets and shells was deadly. General Pakenham was wounded twice and then killed by a shell that exploded near him. Only one British soldier reached the top of the American defenses. The British finally retreated. They left behind more than 2,000 dead and wounded. 500 other British soldiers had been captured. 13 Americans were killed. It was a great victory for the United States, but one that was not necessary. The war had ended by treaty 2 weeks earlier. Historian Alan Taylor says the peace treaty saved the United States from a very grim situation.
the United States government was bankrupt. It had lost its credit, and it could not raise enough in taxes for the war effort. And most creditors were refusing to lend any more money to the United States. And so it was very unclear how the Americans would conduct another campaign in 1815, because it looked like they wouldn't have the money for it.
The Senate acted quickly to approve the treaty. On February 17, 1815, President Madison declared the war officially ended. It had lasted 2 years and 8 months and united the American people. On the 4th of July in 1815, the nation celebrated its 39th anniversary of independence. In Washington, the man who wrote the Star-Spangled Banner, Francis Scott Key, spoke at the celebrations. Historian Alan Taylor says many people call the War of 1812 America's second war for independence, but he calls it America's first civil war. He says the country had been divided throughout the war, but things changed after Andrew Jackson's victory at New Orleans.
And so Americans then concluded that the war had really been a glorious occasion that had defended national honor and proved the merit of their republican institutions. And they were so relieved by all of this that they decided to celebrate the war in their memories.
Albert Gallatin, Madison's Treasury Secretary and one of the negotiators at Ghent, said people felt more American after the war. They feel and act more like a nation. Alan Taylor says the War of 1812 was very difficult for the United States, yet Americans remember it as a feel-good war. At the same time, he says, the War of 1812 also united Canadians.
Despite all of their divisions during the war, they felt so relieved that they had fended off American invasion that they remembered the war as a glorious victory over the more powerful United States.
As a result of the war, Alan Taylor says both Americans and Canadians felt a greater sense of nationalism. And because of that, the two nations could relate more peacefully. Each believed it could survive without having to defeat the other.
And today, Canada and the United States are each other's primary trade and security partner in the world.
But not everyone benefited from the end of the war. The opposition Federalist Party found itself greatly embarrassed by the peace. Its leaders had long denounced the war and said Britain could not be defeated. Many of the Federalists had traded with the enemy. Some had worked with the British against their own country. They had even threatened to break up the Union. Once the war was over, the Federalist Party lost its supporters. And then the party itself soon disappeared, even in the New England states, its base of support. The end of the Federalist Party changed politics in the United States. The changes started as early as the next presidential election in 1816. James Madison continued the tradition begun by George Washington and Thomas Jefferson of serving only 8 years as president.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.